The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ruth Messenger, president of the extraordinary service organization American Jewish World Service. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's been a nearly unbelievable week here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. The horrific events of last Saturday morning, January 8th, when Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and 18 other people were shot at a Safeway supermarket many of us frequent, are well known to the whole world by now. It was a stunning, terrible incident that has changed our community suddenly and painfully. The deaths of Federal District Judge John Roll, Gabby Giffords' aide Gabriel Zimmerman, the 9-year-old girl Christina Taylor Green, Dorwin Stoddard, Phyllis Schneck, and Dorothy Morris, in an act of brutality, have been reviewed constantly by the world's media. The recovery of the wounded has been at the top of every news cycle for a week. President Obama came to Tucson and spoke movingly in a nationally televised memorial service at McHale Center, our college basketball stadium, in front of a huge crowd. And Congresswoman Giffords' condition has gone from dire to hopeful. Prayer services were held and are being held regularly, the first of them at my own Temple Emmanuel last Saturday night. And there is a strange urgency to the city right now. It's not entirely clear where all of this will go. As I said in a prayer that was published on the web the day of the events, at times of great moral outrage, when truly terrible acts are committed, we fluctuate between two emotions. After the initial shock, we are horribly devastated at the tragedy and unspeakable loss. And then we are often angry, furious at the violent and unprincipled slaughter that one individual perpetrated. These are natural emotions, fully human, and they must be experienced completely before healing or understanding can be effected. But the heart of the matter, the Ikar, as the Talmud would describe it, is that after we are shocked, after we are devastated, after we are furiously angry, we must come to terms with what the lives that were stolen meant. We must embrace what the real value of a good human being is: a promising child, an outstanding jurist, a loyal aide, a parent, a sibling, child, a friend. We are taught in Judaism that each human being is created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. In this terrible incident, those images were shattered. It's up to us to pick up the pieces, to make of those broken lives some holiness in our damaged community. May the Holy One teach us how to take this terrible damage and make it into something whole once again. May God give us the strength to face these losses with intelligence, courage, and determination. May God bring those who were wounded to healing and recovery speedily and soon. And may we remember to listen to God. Special note of prayer: Representative Gabrielle Giffords is a good friend to me personally, to my temple, to the district she has served so well, to interfaith work and to understanding, to many good causes and purposes. She is a completely principled person, a warm and caring woman, a proud Jew, a good, even a great Arizonan, all without pretension. She lies terribly injured. We pray that the Merciful One will help her continue to heal and to be whole again. We need Gabby Giffords, and she needs our prayers. I have thought long and hard about what I could add to those sentiments now, a week later. I think the essential message I would add is simply this: if we are to grow from this tragedy, not just Tucson, not just Arizona, but our country, If we are to make something good out of something so profoundly bad, we must strive to reach across all the boundary lines to understand that we can be, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, a beloved community only by turning from anger and hatred to understanding and respect. We must lower the temperature of our rhetoric and increase the depth of our compassion. We must demonstrate the generosity of our hearts and the openness of our hands, rather than the rancor or frustration of our past. If we can do that, then something good will come from this. And that would be a small gift, no, a large gift, to give ourselves, our community, and this troubled world. When we return in a few moments on To Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Ruth Messenger, the president of American Jewish World Service, the extraordinary organization that helps hands-on in the poorest and most needy places in the world at the most important times. Find out where and how when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Well, the new year is here, and you've all probably made your New Year's resolutions. In fact, you might have even broken a few of them already. Well, this year, I'm going to let you in on the resolutions we're making at Mama's. That's right, businesses make resolutions too. Number one, we resolve to be good neighbors and members of our community. We resolve to listen to our customers and respond to their criticisms, complaints, and praise. We resolve to reward employees at Mama's that deliver superior service. We resolve to be fair to our suppliers and to our customers alike. And finally, we resolve to continue making our food lovingly, the way Mom and Pop did. You see, at Mama's, our goal is to be your family's choice for delicious heroes, pizza, calzones, and more. As a result, we hope you'll resolve to come to Mama's as often as you can. Mama's Pizza, with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Ruth Messenger, the president of American Jewish World Service, the international development organization, which works to do grassroots work in the most needy places in the world. It's dedicated to alleviating poverty, hunger, and disease among the peoples of the developing world, regardless of race, religion, or nationality. Very small mission that you have.
Unfortunately, it's very large. The good news is we're growing, and we're attracting more attention from the Jewish community to this work.
I've always been extraordinarily impressed by JJW. And the work that you've done. There's two really hot areas that I see right now. As we do this interview, it's the one-year anniversary of the incredible disaster in Haiti, and AJWS has had grassroots work there for a long time. Tell us about the situation now and what your work is involved in.
Of course. And I think it's an instructive lesson for the world, the situation now. Things are not okay. They had a devastating earthquake in one of the poorest countries in the world with the least infrastructure. And so it really is not a total surprise that well over a million people, probably 1,800,000 people, lost their homes, that 1,300,000 of them are still living in tents and shacks in the public parks and plazas.
With no sanitation.
No sanitation, no easy access to food, no longer any access to farmland, which some of them did have. So it's chaotic. It's not good. But we're talking about a country of people with the strongest constitution, the longest history of fighting against oppression, and they're doing it again. And for American Jewish World Service, it really, Haiti is a place that captures what we're about, because we had 10 grassroots partners in Haiti before the earthquake. so we could target aid directly. We know that the aid we delivered got to people. We know what was happening. We're now strengthening the organizations that we worked with and some new ones we found, so they can indeed build back better.
You know, grassroots work is so different from just sending a bunch of stuff. Can you explain that difference succinctly?
Sure. And people should just think about their home communities. You know, it's that person who decides to turn a free-for-all basketball game on a court into an organized program for young kids. Sometimes there's some money, sometimes there's no money. All over the world, in the poorest communities, there are leaders who step forward and say, we need to plan a better life for our children. Or we need to do a better job of warning about the dangers of bad water or the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. Or we need to start our own mini bank, what's called microfinance. We support 450 groups doing those kinds of work. We fund them. We happen to live in a society that works where $20,000 makes a difference in the life and the development and the human rights of a community. Mm. So there's a lot to do, but the basic work is being done by the indigenous visionaries who know how to pursue justice in their own homes.
We will talk much more about how American Jewish World Service cultivates those visionaries and supports them when we come back a little later this morning with Ruth Messenger on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as a popular podcast. Famed Jewish singer-songwriter Debbie Friedman died last week at the young age of 59, ending her voice, but surely not her music, too soon. To share some reflections with us on her funeral last week, which was webcast to some 7,000 locations, we visited recently with Rabbi Daniel Friedlander, the Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism, a long and trusted friend of Debbie's, and a prominent Reform Jewish musician and scholar himself, and one of the pallbearers at Debbie Friedman's funeral.
Tell us, because of course you have such an extraordinary musical background, tell us what Debbie really meant, and tell us a little bit about the funeral.
Well, the funeral was a celebration of her life, but it was almost like a soundtrack of my Jewish world for the past 40 years. The eulogies and the music of the service were very closely tied together in an absolutely brilliant way. And I've never been to a funeral where the congregation sang along at virtually every point of the funeral whenever there was music, and there was a lot of music. But I guess that's appropriate. That's exactly what Debbie's core message was, that Jewish music was for the community to realize their own spirituality. It wasn't for the community to listen to a cantor or a choir express a composer's spiritual intention, but rather the role of music is to unlock the spirituality in each and every Jew. And you only do that by singing. So Debbie's legacy played out at the funeral, was alive at the funeral.
We were talking earlier this week about what Reformed Jewish music was like before the kind of camp revolution, which Debbie Friedman was really the key, I don't know, would you say she was the inception of the whole thing? She was sort of the motivating force at times.
Well, Debbie was really one of three revolutions that took place in the late 60s, early 70s. And one of them was the Hasidic Song Festival, right, which created, Al Shlosha Devarim, or Ohosesha
Shalom Bin Ramah, all the Karlbach.
So that's Shlomo Karlbach precedes even that.
Right.
So he's writing very singable melodies that slowly were infiltrating into the Reform movement. In the early 70s, Debbie, Mike Isaacson, Jeff Klepper start writing dozens and dozens and dozens of songs in the style of the Hasidic Song Festival, or in the style of Shlomo Karlbach, almost entirely in Hebrew, except they started focusing on worship texts, on liturgical texts. And so all of a sudden, by the time you get to 1974, you have this big package of Jewish musical materials available for worship that never existed before. We just don't have any evidence before the early 1970s, late 60s, of popular melodies being written for Reformed Jewish worship. You have, Darius Milhaud writes a worship service. Bernstein writes.
Right.
Great composers, right? Schubert even wrote a Tov Lehodot. But those were performance pieces. They were for a choir and an orchestra and soloist, but they definitely weren't for the congregation to sing along. The congregation's participation in worship was limited to singing hymns, which took place at three or four times during the service. There was always an opening hymn, a hymn before the sermon, a hymn after the sermon, and a closing hymn, and they were usually in English. And if you recall the Union Hymnal, which came out in 1897, and really was in print through the late 60s, that's the Reformed Judaism that I did, in fact, grow up in.
God is in his holy
temple. God is in his holy temple. Earthly thoughts be silent now, while with reverence we assemble and before his presence bow. So there were a lot of... the Reform movement in the 1890s stole a lot of Methodist and Episcopalian hymns and cleaned up, got rid of the Jesus language.
And a few Lutheran ones, too.
And put them in the hymnal. But there were only four Hebrew hymns in the Union Hymnal. They were In Keloheinu, Adon Olam, and I don't remember what else. I honestly don't remember what else, but there were four Hebrew in there. So the Jews were used to singing, but they just weren't used to singing in Hebrew. And Debbie's revolution was popular American melodies, not 19th century hymns, and Hebrew. All Hebrew all the time.
It's funny because so many people associate Debbie with, for example, the English via Haftah or the Misha Berach, which has some Hebrew, but of course plenty of English. And yet the truth is most of her stuff is Hebrew settings.
Well, if you look at her first 10 years of compositions, that's the 1970s, there are only a handful of songs with any English in it. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God is one. Maybe Sing unto God is another. But the rest were all in Hebrew. It's only within the 1980s, when she started writing her spiritual texts, that she chose to integrate Hebrew and English so that the Jews would understand the message. She assumed that people would understood the liturgical texts because they saw them over and over, and their translations were in the prayer books. But you couldn't assume that with a text like Lechilach or Misha Berach. So there were always one or two Hebrew words, but the message was always explicit and was always in English.
There were, 7,000 or 8,000 people watching the I don't want to say telecast, the webcast of the funeral, plus, perhaps 800 or 1,000 people at the funeral. What was that experience like for you?
So it was overwhelming. It was a reunion of Jewish musicians who played off of one another and helped each other create and recorded with one another in the 1970s, people that I just hadn't seen in 25, 30, 35 years. There was a series of record albums in the 70s called Songs Nifty Sings.
I remember
those. And all of them always had one or two or three Debbie Friedman songs, and one or two or three Jeff Klepper songs.
Jeff Klepper, Danny Friedlander songs.
Yes, yes. And a Michael Isaacson song, and a Uchiha Shlomo Carl Bach song. But every 2 years, a new album would come out and would include the next round of Jewish hits. Well, all those people were present. Mm. So it was a real reunion of the Jewish music community, including the Cage community, which in the 80s and 90s, but the 80s in particular, really nurtured a whole generation of new musicians like Doug Kotler, like Craig Taubman. And then there was a current generation of Jewish performers, Michelle Citrin, Josh Nelson, Julie Silver, who were also participating in the funeral. So it was, you know, three generations of Jewish musicians coming together, because Debbie was the matriarch of that genre of Jewish music. She created it, she performed it, she never stopped creating, and everyone there was indebted to her, because they're really a product of what she started.
You know, sort of the last ad, there was a special... The casket had a special contribution on top of it. Put a guitar on.
Yeah, it was a little weird. there, with her guitar, with a broken string, in fact, was sitting on top of her casket. Now, Debbie is notorious. She strummed very, very hard. She had a unique strum, and she was always breaking strings in the middle of concert. So, a string would break in the middle of concert. She would insist on changing her own string,
and she would stop and talk.
Which is why the concerts always ran long, but symbolically was her guitar and a broken string on top of her casket as we walked in and through the entire funeral.
I want to thank Danny Friedlander for a wonderful insight into a difficult and extraordinary funeral. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks.
It's ironic that Debbie Friedman died on the week of Shabbat B'Shalach, the week of the Sabbath of song. We welcome our expert on Israel, our maven, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Tu B'Shvat is nearly here. We started celebrating last weekend at Temple Manuel. We'll keep doing it this week when it falls. Chag Tu B'Shvat Sameach.
Chag Tu B'Shvat Sameach. Hashkediah Porachat.
Shemesh, but well, never mind. Go on.
Yeah.
I could sing the whole song for
between
you.
Us. And I would like to talk a little bit about Tu B'Shvat in Israel.
Please.
And Tu B'Shvat is celebrated in Israel traditionally by planting new trees, because it is considered to be a great mitzvah to plant a tree in the Holy Land, in the land of Israel. And usually all the school kids, all the kindergarten kids, they go to one place or the other, and they plant trees. And it's interesting because Israel was the only Western country that at the year 2000 had more trees than it had at the end of the 19th century.
Wow.
So it's amazing.
That's a fascinating fact when you think about it. Wow.
It is fascinating, you know, when you look at environmental issues. Because it's and in a way, it's thanks to Tu B'Shvat, because that's the tradition to go and plant trees. And it's our way, you know, to say, okay, while the rest of the world are cutting trees off, we plant them. We and they bring us the air, you know, they bring us everything, the oxygen. And it's a very nice holiday. And we eat, it's funny, we eat in Israel also those... like dates and dry fruits.
Right, apricots, dates, grape, well, raisins, things like that.
Now, originally, this tradition comes from Europe, where they didn't have the fresh fruit, So they would bring fruits from Israel that were dry fruits. But this tradition went all the way back to Israel. And now when it's Tu B'Shvat, you go to the store and you buy the dry fruits just because of the tradition. You know?
Even though you can get fresh fruits then, because right. It's a warm climate, they grow year-round. Really yeah, so funny. So one of the really nice aspects of Tu B'Shvat. Thanks, Guy. Have a wonderful Tu B'Shvat. Enjoy your Seder or your dried fruits. And we'll talk next week.
Tu B'Shvat Sameach.
Tu B'Shvat Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6th. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife, although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about diplomatic recognition and a variety, I guess four, maybe five new South American countries, Latin American countries, have recognized Palestine recently. There are some 130 countries around the world that have recognized Palestine as a state, which means there are a lot that haven't, including the United States, Israel, obviously. It does seem to me that, in a way, it's sort of startling when you think about it, your existence as a state depends on what other people think about you. Because if they don't recognize you and give you that status, then, you know, by me, you're a state, by him, you're a state, but by the United States, you're not a state.
Absolutely.
That's actually how it works, huh?
Right. I mean, it's like the old conundrum. If a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, does it make a noise? Okay, so if a state declares its existence, but it's not recognized by anyone, does it exist? Well, a very recent example is Kosovo, which is regarded by Serbia as an autonomous region within Serbia, and for many years was satisfied with its status as an autonomous region within the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. A certain number of states have recognized the independence of Kosovo, and at some point it will gain critical mass. And whether that's 40 states recognizing it or 90 or 120, you don't need all 186 or whatever it is states in the world to recognize you in order to exist. You simply need a good number of states that actually matter. And it's particularly helpful if they are states that matter to you. So, you know, in the case of Palestine, probably diplomatic recognition granted or withheld from Tonga doesn't really matter a lot. But from the United States or members of the European Union probably does. And with diplomatic recognition come certain privileges and the right to make treaties and extradite people and open embassies and establish trade agreements and all that stuff, which is very hard to do with a state that you don't recognize, right? Is that any clearer than
yes,
it was
I think
last
it is.
Week?
Okay. So, Reese, you were just in South America. Seems like there's a big push now for South American states to recognize Palestine. It was Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia. Now Peru is under pressure to do the same thing. Is it perhaps Chile? Is there a reason why there's this big push now?
Well, there are probably several. For one thing, particularly in the case of Brazil, Brazil as an independent, valid diplomatic actor, as a political player on the world stage, is more and more recognized as it is a South American leader. It has a huge economy, a huge population. It's taken some very helpful initiatives recently. And so Brazil is definitely among the countries that matter, like India and China, although not quite as big. It's not a country that can be overlooked. The other countries, of course, were all once Spanish colonies and have a complicated history of their own vis-a-vis Israel and vis-a-vis the Jewish people, which we can perhaps discuss next week.
Why don't we? Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Young Dr. Levine is replacing the recently retired Dr. Cohen. He comes into the room to see his elderly patient, Mrs. Goldberg. He looks through Mrs. Goldberg's chart, and he's startled to see that his predecessor had her on birth control pills. In fact, she's in the office specifically to get a renewal on her prescription. Mrs. Goldberg, the young doctor says, do you realize these are birth control pills? You're in your 80s. Why do you have them? Well, doctor, they help me sleep better at night. Dr. Levine answers, I assure you, there's absolutely nothing in birth control pills that could possibly help you sleep better at night. Mrs. Goldberg reaches over, gently pats Dr. Levine on the knee and says, oh, yes, they do. I get up very early, every morning, grind up one from the pills, mix it in the orange juice I give my 16-year-old granddaughter. Believe me, doctor, this helps me sleep better at night. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and drink your orange juice. And now a word of Torah. When I was a kid, my dad tried very hard to get me to memorize certain central passages in Jewish tradition, believing they would become a more important part of my education and identity if they were learned be'al peh, by heart. The first of these was the Shema and Ve'ahavta, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and the statement of the need to love God with all our hearts, minds, and souls. I learned that very young, as so many Jewish children have throughout history. Other important passages followed, some from the Bible, some from Mishnah, some from the prayer book. You know, my ability to memorize has always been a little shaky. I even tend to forget lyrics of favorite songs. Just ask my wife or kids about that. They tease me unmercifully. But as a kid, in spite of my limitations, I learned many passages by heart. And that early memorization created a base of knowledge that, as my dad intended, has served me very well over the years. But on one text, I failed. When I was 9, my dad tried to get me to memorize the Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 commandments in Hebrew and English. It was a logical assignment. They are Dibrot, after all, spoken declarations, and putting them into memory permanently so they could be spoken at any time simply makes sense. But I struggled with this assignment for some reason, and so eventually he upped the ante. If I successfully memorized the Ten Commandments, I would get to go to the L.A. Coliseum to see the up-and-coming L.A. Rams football team play the New York Jets, then defending Super Bowl champs, featuring star quarterback Joe Namath. It's quite a bribe for a sports-obsessed boy of 9. And yet, in spite of that major inducement, I just couldn't memorize the Ten Commandments. The first of the statements, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, well, that was easy. But the second commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, was a nightmare, with its elaborate delineation of just how we are not to worship idols and what constitutes other gods and their images. I never did get the second commandment down. And somehow the passage about the Sabbath kept getting confused in my mind with other texts about Shabbat. Vayechulu from Genesis that we do before Shabbos Kiddush, and Vishamru from Friday night services and Saturday's Kiddush. I really tried hard to memorize the Ten Commandments. I copied them out in pencil in Hebrew and English. I recited them repeatedly. I made and used flashcards, all to no avail. I just could not get all 10 statements by heart. You know, my dad was a caring but consistent father. To him, a deal was a deal. We never did get to go to that game, and I learned an early, painful lesson about the consequences of failure. Somehow, when I found out my Rams lost that game to the Jets, I felt personally responsible. If only I'd memorized the Ten Commandments, we would have gone. Surely my team would then have won. Over time, I've come to realize the Ten Commandments are a challenge for more than a 9-year-old boy. Whether we know them by heart or not, and I suspect most of us don't, these 10 statements that are supposed to be the only words God ever spoke directly to humanity are not really at the heart of even our Judaism today. This has been true traditionally throughout history to a degree. The Ten Commandments aren't in any regular liturgy in Jewish tradition. They're absent from most prayer books. And the rabbis of the Talmud regularly tell us that there are not only 10, but 613 commandments. And we have to do all of them, not just these 10. You know, no matter how many Torah breastplates have the image of the tablets, there's an ambivalence about the centrality of this great revelation, even in our own classic religious tradition, even for Orthodox Jews. But the difficulty with the Ten Commandments is much more true for we progressive, liberal Jews. In point of fact, we have trouble with a lot of the Ten and try to find relevant ways to observe them, not always succeeding. Every commandment kind of brings a problem, even the most positively phrased. What does it mean to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy if we work every Shabbat? I recall attending the URJ Biennial Convention in Toronto, hearing Rabbi Eric Yaffe thank the delegates at services for celebrating a non-wired Shabbat, free of iPhones or Blackberries. His remarks were immediately posted on Facebook by many of the delegates using the same smartphones they were supposed to have put away for the Sabbath. All the commandments, well, nearly all anyway, have complications. How are we to suitably honor our fathers and mothers if they're challenging people for us? Not murdering or stealing is clear enough, but how can we possibly avoid being jealous of our neighbor's better job or nicer car? And don't we take God's name in vain all the time without apparent repercussions? You know, for all of that, I believe the commandment that we have the gravest difficulty observing for Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, all the non-Orthodox Jews, is the first one. It's the simple statement that there's a God who commands us at all. Now, this statement, which contains no commandment, has been considered by Christians a kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments. Doesn't even get a number for them. But we Jews have always insisted on understanding it as a unique and critical statement. Why? Because as logical as the Ten Commandments may seem, if we do not accept the existence of a mitzvah, a commander, they essentially lose their power. Without a commander, there's no recipient of the command. And in practical terms, no mitzvah, no commandment to be kept at all. This is why the Ten Commandments are not called the Ten Suggestions, or the Ten Recommendations, or the Ten Nice Ideas if you can manage to do them. It is only when we accept the existence of God, when we diminish our own elaborate sense of self, that we're able to partner with God to try to create a moral world. Only when we engage with the commander do we find the commandments. And so, in spite of all the difficulties we have with these Ten Commandments, including our objection to putting them up on the walls of courtrooms or classrooms, they are central to our culture. And if we are to be Jews and holy, they must remain so. If we can do this, then we will observe the Ten Commandments just as they were intended to be observed, by heart. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll meet with Ruth Messenger, the outstanding president of American Jewish World Service, which helps make a difference in the poorest and neediest places around the world. Find out what most aid organizations, nearly all, are doing wrong, and why, when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle.
It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
With all the news in today's show about Tucson and Debbie Friedman, we have an abbreviated news segment. Just one story today, but, well, it's kind of comedy relief and factual. Well, it's kind of funny. In Israel, they are calling it Bragate. The head of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's press office apologized last week for the intensive security screening journalists were subjected to before a cocktail party they were invited to by the government. Several members of the Foreign Press Corps who showed up for the party last Tuesday with personal invitations and press cards they can only get after background checks were told to undress during screenings conducted by Israel's Shin Bet Security Service. It's being called Bragate by the Jerusalem Post because one Arab Israeli journalist working for Al Jazeera, Najwan Simri Diab, was denied entry because she agreed to take off some of her clothes but refused to remove her bra. An Israeli photographer, Menachem Kahana, got even more screening. He had to take off his trousers. The Foreign Press Service Association in Tel Aviv said that it was outraged over the treatment members received at the hands of Israeli security personnel during the invitation-only gathering with the prime minister. While we appreciate the need for security, it is not remotely acceptable to invite people for cocktails at a five-star hotel and make them undress at the door. Some, including the bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, were strip-searched. A number of members walked out in disgust. Oren Hellman, the director of Israel's government press office, wrote in a letter to the Foreign Press Association, "I'd like to express my regret that journalists left the annual cocktail reception feeling they were treated in an unbecoming manner by security. And how? Obviously, we do not invite journalists to an event in order to offend them. But, being Israelis, sometimes you manage to do it anyway." Well, let's get them redressed and hopefully reinvited. That's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Ruth Messenger. She's the president of American Jewish World Service, the visionary international development organization driven by its focus on Jewish ideals, trying to bring assistance and help and organization and service and advocacy to some of the poorest and most needy places in the world. We were talking in the first part of the show about how grassroots organizations work. And tell me a little bit about how AJWS goes into a place like, say, Haiti or the Sudan and helps without sort of coming from the top down.
Okay, I want to leave Sudan out for a minute because it's really a different story.
Sure.
But in Haiti, before the earthquake, we were there. We identified, when I say we were there, I mean people on the grant staff in our New York City office who are divided regionally, Asia, Africa, and the Americas, travel regularly to the countries in which we've determined to work. Very often they have a lead. Somebody's talked to us. People find out about us. People that we're already helping, organizations that are already helping, refer us to other organizations that are strong in their communities. It's quite a network. But when our staff is investigating a program, let's say a program in Haiti of women who have been going into the agricultural towns, communities for years and teaching people, sometimes drip irrigation to control water, which of course
very important.
Technology developed very, in Israel.
Very Jewish. It's very Israeli Jewish. Technology.
Or crop rotation, or other ways to strengthen the soil, or ways to share healthy seed collaboratively, or ways to store the produce from the earth till it's the price is right in the market. Whatever these techniques, here is a network of people who realize that their communities needed to improve their agricultural yield. They learned some of the expertise. They're spreading it village by village. They need some operating money. When we find a group like that, and let's say we've just found a new group, it's Sam, often months of back and forth by phone, by email, with them submitting finally a proposal, which we help them to write, but which has built-in accountability and built-in monitoring and built-in structure for evaluation. And then we'll give them the money to do the work that they've promised to do. And perhaps not surprisingly, the work gets done.
You know, Tikkun Olam, as it's interpreted so frequently, is social action, but it's a broad range of approaches. There are so many NGOs in the world now, non-governmental organizations, doing some kind of advocacy and assistance. What's the unique area that American Jewish World Service has created?
We talk all the time about something you already picked up on, that is finding the grassroots groups and the real people on the ground. And second of all, about learning what they are about and what they would like money for. There are just many, too many non-governmental organizations, some well-known to your listeners, very important organizations. But you know what they do? They sit in London or Washington or New York or Geneva and they say, let's do literacy next year. And that means spending millions of dollars hiring Western-based experts, sending them to be field officers and to set up programs. And it's not that they don't do the work, they do. And of course, some of it has a significant impact on a community. But if you are a parent in a agricultural village in Peru, and you are most worried about the number of children in your community who have malnutrition and are at risk of disease, then literacy may not be your thing this year. So the question is, what is your thing? What is your group trying to do? And how can we help you? And the other aspect of American Jewish World Service that we treasure, which you sort of referenced, is we do both development, expansion of human rights through these grassroots groups, and we do advocacy, usually in the United States, sometimes at the UN, and with other world powers, to say, change the way some of these systems work. So let's go back to Haiti for a minute. When people in Port-au-Prince, over a million people, have had their total lives disrupted by the earthquake. They lost their physical structures in which they lived. They're thrown into a place where they, if they had employment, which was not hugely likely, they have no jobs, no access to food. Okay, so the powers of the world say, oh, they're hungry now, they had an earthquake, let's ship food. And everyone listening would think, of course. But guess what? They're farmers in Haiti. There are rice farmers in Haiti. Their rice grew, and they were ready to figure out, okay, can't quite take it to market because some of the markets have disappeared.
Not to mention the transportation.
How do we get our rice to the people in Port-au-Prince who need it? Only to find out that the U.S. was delivering tons of rice.
15 metric tons.
15,000
metric tons. Wow.
And so
they no longer had a market for their product.
Right. And this is happening all over the world, not just where Haiti is. Too many places where the U.S. decides that there's a need for some surplus food, and I'm not saying that nobody's hungry or nobody's malnourished, but we deliver it in a fashion in which sometimes it's given out by the government. More often, I'm sorry to say, it's intercepted.
Stolen.
People who take it to market. But guess what? They got it free, so they can sell it at less than the local farmer can take it to market. So these are complex systems. Now, the point that I want to make sure your listeners understand is we're not going to change all of these systems, but there are ways to work on these issues. So there are ways both to work with an organization like ours to help a local farmer, and there are ways to lobby Congress right now that from this moment on, based on this experience in Haiti, all American foreign aid bills should require local procurement first.
One of the really important areas in the world, Sudan, had a huge election the second week of January. It's an area of Darfur. It's an area of genocide, an area of internal civil war, external pressures, financial disasters, corruption. AJWS has been involved in advocacy and in other ways. Tell us a little bit about your
work. Well, so we've been working on the problem in Darfur which was the site and is the site of an ongoing genocide.
Right. It's not like it's done.
It's not done. It's not over. It wasn't last year's event. Nobody is burning towns to the ground because there are almost no towns left in Darfur. Most of the people who lived in tiny little villages in Darfur are now living in what are called camps for internally displaced persons, or they've moved across the border to Chad and they're living in refugee camps. So their lives are also totally up in the air. That's evidence of an ongoing genocide. We'll never know how many people were killed in Darfur. We really, the world does not think we will, but let's say 400,000. Then it turned out that as we were doing, and you were correct, some humanitarian aid on the ground, have a teacher in this camp, create a health clinic here, and we were doing some of that. We were also doing, with lots of branches of the Jewish community in this country, I'm proud to say, more and more work to say to the White House and Congress, intercede and stop this genocide. We began to get some traction, and then it really became clear that it's peace for all of Sudan or nothing. That there was a war between the north and the south, separate from Darfur. That there was a preliminary truce between the north and the south, signed in 2005, that promised elections in 2011. And it just became clear to all of us who were activists and advocates that unless there is a peaceful election, which is likely to move toward the separation and therefore the creation of two countries, North Sudan, which is sort of where the government of Sudan is now, and South Sudan, unless that happens, the plight of the people in the West, in Darfur, will also not be addressed. So the good news is that President Obama, in an op-ed in the New York Times, both Democratic and Republican members of Congress have put a lot of pressure, that there's a spotlight on South Sudan right now to conduct this first referendum to vote for secession peacefully, telling the North essentially, keep hands off, do not foment violence during the process of this election. And that election, I have to say, which began on January 9th and runs for at least a week, is running more smoothly, like I should say a quick prayer, than most of us imagined it would 6 months ago, partly because the governments of the world are really spotlighting the need for an end to violence, including an end to violence in Darfur. And the American Jewish community that worked on Darfur should take a lot of credit for having moved this issue into a central international spotlight issue.
How can people help in ways that are not emptying their closets and giving their old stuff or voting to send American blankets to countries too hot to need them?
Well, the first thing I would say is sort of learn what's going on. Our newspapers do a really pretty poor job of talking about most of the countries where American Jewish World Service works. I'd urge people to be in touch with you and your program about things they'd like to know more about. We would love for you on a regular basis, not just today, to advertise our website, which is www.ajws.org. Right now, there's
we'll put up a link on the Two Jewish website as well.
Right now, there's a slideshow of some of our work in Haiti. I called it our Hanukkah miracle. We gave a group of women in one of the camps where the rape incidence was the highest solar flashlights. Which get charged by the sun every day, and then they organized latrine patrols so no girl or woman was walking through the camp alone in the dark, and totally changed the life of that camp and empowered themselves. That seemed to be a good thing to talk about at Hanukkah, but yeah. I'm still talking about it. So it's those kinds of changes. So learn from our website. Spread what you learn. Many of your listeners are involved in civic organizations, in congregations. Look, make these a place to talk about this. Our website will always give you options for, it's called Take Action. It's a section of our website. And it will say, you can write your member of Congress about the need for local procurement. You can write your member of Congress about the fact that the Congress of the United States has not yet ratified the International Violence Against Women Act, ratified by most of the major countries of the world already, but not us. So there's lots of ways to do advocacy. And then, of course, we make no secret about it. We're a fundraising organization, and what we say to people is, literally, we are an organization that puts into practice the Jewish dictum. If you save one life, you save the world.
So I'll add one more Jewish quote, Im loach shaveh matai, if not now, when? I want to thank Ruth Messenger for a great visit here on Two Jewish, ajws.org. You can go to their website, American Jewish World Service, and see all the great work they're doing, and you can help.
Nice.
Thank, Thanks very much, Ruth. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be the brilliant, beautiful Israeli journalist Natasha Mozgovaya, the chief U.S. correspondent for Haaretz newspaper. Our playout this morning comes from the late Debbie Friedman, Lechi Lach, go to the place I will show you, for her journey now. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.